Good morning.
Good morning, sir.
How many of you read the email that Bill sent out about the Heart Sutra? And the heart of this discussion of the of Prajna Paramita referred to two sides of Buddhism. The first part was, as Buddhism developed, a lot of emphasis was placed on knowledge and the accumulation of knowledge about the various aspects of Buddhism. And then following that, the emphasis was placed on before knowledge. What is Buddhism without knowledge? And so jhana, J-A-N-A, was the focus on knowledge, on study. And the other part, the other side, was prajna, which is wisdom. In the spirit of this, I have a question. Can somebody tell me what this is? My authority stick. Anybody else have any idea what this is? Just throw out an idea.
A branch from the
tree of life. Bill? No? I don't know. Well, that's a good place to start. So when I hold up this stick, I ask you, what do you see? And most people will say a stick or identify it in some more specific way. This is actually a root. I forget the kind of tree, but Charles Burks, who is a Zen teacher in my lineage, it's down south. I've forgotten the state. Do you know when?
Virginia,
okay. And this comes from Virginia. So each of us who have become Dharma holders, been made teachers, are given by Charles one of these sticks. Right? So as I was saying, you know, some people will identify this as a stick, or a root, the root of an apple tree, or a segment of a vine. So actually, the reason that I hold up this stick is to introduce you to the universe, to the source, which we call, in this article, prana. And many people will not understand. They will say, what are you talking about? It's just a stick. Or maybe, sometimes, the more cynical people will say, that sounds like a lot of spiritual crap, right? Right here, spiritual crap. So what prevents us from seeing that this stick is the entire universe right now being held up before each one of us? That's the universe. So let me begin to answer this question that I presented by reading a poem by Peter Levitt from a book of poems entitled 100 Butterflies. Already at birth, I was parted, not just from my mother, but body from mind, mind from its source. That's why I take up this soft blade of breath to cut me back into one. So this soft blade of breath is zazen. Right? That's the activity that we take up to cut ourselves back into one. So the womb, to change directions, the womb is a place of oneness and intimacy, if you think about it. And when we leave the womb, we enter the world of form. And we begin a lifelong induction into duality. And how does this induction take place? A helpful way to understand this induction is to look at some of the ways we develop, both psychologically and biologically. And people who are interested in development know that one of the most rapidly developing parts of a newborn is its brain. And research shows that a newborn starts thinking even before they learn to speak. Babies as young as 5 months old make distinctions and categorize certain types of events. The nature of this categorization changes and gets more and more sophisticated with age. As the child's learning evolves, he or she is introduced to a variety of names, concepts, identities, hierarchies, goods, bad, etc. And this process continues through elementary school, high school, college, and life in general. This process contributes to a view of the world as dualistic. From a psychological perspective, one of the major developmental tasks of childhood, and this was identified by Erik Erikson, famous psychologist, so one of the major developmental tasks of childhood is the separation and individuation phase. Very difficult, I might add, for parents. So this is the process, as I said, where the child separates from his parents and develops into an independent identity. And this further contributes to a sense that we live in a dualistic world. Me and Dad, me and Mom, or the other way around, me and my son, me and my daughter. So thinking plays a large part in the way in which we see the world and experience ourselves in relation to it. Researchers estimate that we have between 3,000 and 5,000 thoughts per day. Imagine that, 3,000 to 5,000 thoughts per day. And each one of these thoughts is an induction into perceiving everything around us in a dualistic way. The frequency and content of all these thoughts create what we name reality. And as the existentialists say, we are what we think. So let me share a couple of examples of how thinking affects our perception of ourselves and the world around us. I recently read an article about how surgeons are trained to be very careful of the conversations they have during surgery, even though the patient is under anesthesia. And the reason for this is that research shows that negative suggestions such as, oh man, he's a real bleeder, or she's going to have a tough recovery, are heard subliminally and can have a pronounced negative effect on the outcome of surgery. Similarly, stress management programs focus on how a participant's self-talk, the thoughts they have, affect their circumstances. This attention to thoughts is based on research which shows that negative self-talk heightens stress, disrupts appetite, causing over or under eating, disturbed sleep, and so forth. Again, it can have a bunch of negative effects. And the conclusion of these researchers confirms what meditation teachers have known for a long time, that again, thoughts create our reality. So these are a couple examples of how powerful and persuasive thought is, and how it affects the perception of reality. So if I'm repeatedly creating negative thoughts, I'm going to live in a negative reality. This thought-created reality will affect our relationships, our health, and our sense of being in the world. Likewise, if I pick up this stick and just see a stick, I will be demonstrating an incomplete understanding of this stick. It's not just a stick. That's one side of what this is. So it is a stick, yes, that's true, but it is also, we call in Zen, a non-stick. A non-stick is just this, right? No labels, just this. Which means, a non-stick means that it is empty, as I said, of a particular identity. And when we realize it's not limited to the identity we've assigned to it by our thoughts, we realize it's universal. It's not contained by ideas. It's empty of ideas. Its non-dual relationship with the universe is its fundamental oneness. So to conclude, if we just live in a reality created by our thoughts, a dualistic reality, we will be out of balance. We need the soft blade of breath to help us re-experience the oneness and intimacy we knew before we became separated from the source. We need the practice of Zazen to open the doorway back to this source. But even this is not the end of our journey. We don't want to lean in the direction of empty oneness either. We must be moderate, be centered, not leaning or holding to either expression of reality. Just form, just emptiness, dancing inseparably from each other. So we don't push away an idea of stick or vine, right? It is. It's a stick. It's a vine. That's how you know the twist in it. But it's something else, which is it's empty. It has no identity. That's the non-stick part. So let me end with a poem entitled by Museum Vase by Robert Francis. which reads as follows. It contains nothing, and we ask it to contain nothing. Having transcended use, it is endlessly content to be. But still, it broods on old burdens, wheat, oil, and wine. Just to add something which I think is sort of related to this. My wife and I took her nephew up to the Berklee College, which is a music-oriented school, entirely invested in music. And her nephew, actually, as a child, sang in the New York Metropolitan Opera. And now he's in heavy metal. It's quite a switch. But he's very talented. So we drove up, and then yesterday we drove back and got home late because of endless traffic. And I was thinking, I was driving, you know, every now and then you'd see cars that were all dented up with a police car on the side, and somehow it passed in my mind, up, lost their mindfulness of driving, you know. So anyway, while we were driving back and sitting in traffic, Cindy, my wife, has been taking a gardening class in the city. And it's given by a 24-year-old guy who's a gardener and a horticulturalist. So she read her notes, which I don't know how she took these notes. I thought she was reading some kind of syllabus or program or whatever that the guy handed out about his talk, which somehow she was able to almost literally, word by word, capture his talk. So it was probably 15 minutes long. He talked first about soil and all the ingredients in soil and how you get a balanced soil or an unbalanced soil and how you can cultivate that. But then he talked about the effect of the different types of soil on whether a plant will grow or whether a plant won't grow. And then he talked about the interrelationship of insects and flowers. And it was on and on and on. And I was sitting there thinking, what a beautiful and exquisite demonstration it is of both prajna and jhana, right? He's telling a story, right, which is knowledge. He's explaining all this. But at the same time, it's exquisite. It's this interrelationship. It's like an example of the universe. It's like a stick, how all these parts function together. And if you add something or you subtract something, it affects everything, not just some simple part, which is sort of like karma, you know. If karma goes in this direction, well, life will unfold in this direction. If karma goes in this direction, it'll unfold in a different way, because everything is connected. So this guy's expression of it touched both the knowledge side and also the emptiness or the wisdom side, and the wisdom being this exquisite interrelationship of how all this goes together. So anyway, that's an impromptu add to my talk. Thank you.